arrived to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Rob Cowan.
Thank you, Ian. And a warm welcome from me here at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, which is being given by a stripling among French orchestras, the 27-year-old Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, under its music director, Myung-Wong Chung. It's a varied and colourful programme tonight in around a quarter of an hour, a BBC co-commission with Radio France and a UK premiere, Morning in Long Island by Pascal Dusapin. Then, after the interval, the most affable and expansive of Beethoven's concertos, the so-called triple for violin, cello and piano, with the brothers Renaud and Gauthier Capucin and the pianist Franck Braly, all of them making their prom debuts. But first tonight, an early work by Olivier Messiaen, music full of mystery but with plenty of fierce drama at its heart. Les Offrandes Oubliées, The Forgotten Offerings, his very first published orchestral work. The year 1930, which was just after he finished his studies at the Paris Conservatoire. Its premiere was auspicious. One critic commented on its bold originality, meaning, I would imagine, its three-tier structure, the slow opening representing Christ's sacrifice on the cross, which in turn is answered in the most violent terms by a breathless, frenzied, ceaseless descent into sin and then into the grave, which, for the concluding minutes of the work, brings both great love and great pity. At least that's the marking on the score, which represents the Eucharist and with it, inevitably, Christ's love for mankind. That applause is for Myung-Wong Chung, who now conducts the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France in Les Offrandes Oubliées, The Forgotten Offerings by Olivier Messiaen.
Thank you.
utterly magical. Les offrandes oubliées, the forgotten offerings by Olivier Messiaen. There we heard the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung Whun Chung. Whenever I come back to Messiaen's music after a bit of an absence, as I have tonight, it's like revisiting a familiar dreamscape that you haven't visited for a while. It's enrapturing. It quite takes you over. Even an early piece like that, Forgotten Offerings, which we've just heard. Incidentally, Chung is a featured artist in Classical Collection every day this week here on Radio 3 from 10 a.m. And French music is one of the threads running through the proms this year. Full details at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, next tonight, a BBC co-commission with Radio France and a UK premiere. Music by an extremely prolific and versatile composer, Pascal Dussopin, who thinks of himself as fundamentally melancholy. "I have a happy life," he says, "but it was not given to me. It is the fruit of a lot of work." Dussopin has been composing since he was 18 years old. He's now in his late 50s, and he's been described in print as the best known and most played composer in France and abroad since Henri Dutilleux. The work we're going to hear tonight is called Morning in Long Island, or Concert No. 1 for large orchestra. I met up with the Dussopin after the rehearsal this morning and asked him to set the scene for us. Where did the inspiration for the piece come from?
A very bizarre moment I had when I was living in New York in 88, 89. I was on the beach a very early morning, you know. It was a morning in October, and I was freezed, totally freezed. And I walked on the beach, and I had an impression absolutely crazy about the nature, about the movement of the wind, the sound of the sea, the movement of the nature around me. I was totally in the nature. It was a very new emotion for me. And a French guy, a writer, Olivier Cadieux, told me, "One day you should write a piece with this title, Morning in Long Island." I didn't forget that. And more than 20 years after, I did it.
There we are, Pascal Dussopin. Well, the work is scored for a large symphony orchestra, quadruple woodwinds and brass, harp plus the standard percussion and timpani with a substantial string section. These forces are augmented by a trio of brass instruments, trumpet, horn and trombone, which are placed in the hall itself, either around the orchestra or surrounding the audience. I can tell you from the rehearsal this morning that the effect was quite incredible. It was interesting while I watched the rehearsal personally. At 9:30 there was an offstage brass rehearsal in the hall where the brass instruments echoed from opposite sides of the arena. Dussopin himself paced across the great painted circle of the Albert Hall in the middle of the arena, which was otherwise empty, listening and then going up to Myung Whun Chung to comment on what he'd heard. He had a lot to say, including some corrections to the parts since the premiere last month. Well, that applause is from Myung Whun Chung, who now conducts the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France in Morning in Long Island by Pascal Dussopin.
Thank you. Thank you.
pure genius, that ending on a diminuendo on the timpani. The mystery, anger, terror and exultation, all part of the rich tapestry of sound that Sir Pascal Gusapin's Morning in Long Island, his concert number one for large orchestra, that was the UK premiere performed by the forces that gave the world premiere just 3 weeks ago at the Salle Pleyel in Paris. The Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung Bung Chung, and the composer himself, Pascal Gusapin, is now taking his bow in front of a very enthusiastic audience. The orchestra rises to its feet. Such a striking piece, that. You never quite knew where it was going to turn, even after hearing it a couple of times this morning. It still amazed me listening to it tonight. And there'll be more Gusapin at the Proms later this month. You can check the Proms website for more details, bbc.co.uk/proms. Interesting to hear, or read rather, I should say, Julian Anderson, the composer, in the programme notes for tonight's Prom. Here we are. Before I mention that, I must say that Gusapin has returned again, applauding the orchestra and bowing again to the audience. Wonderful tight ensemble from the orchestra there. I say nature's always been one of Dusapin's main sources of inspiration, says Julian Anderson. Not the pastoral idea of the Romantics, nor the picturesque grandeur of Messiaen's Birdsong, but rather the wild, unspoilt vehemence of rivers and torrents. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. In just over 20 minutes, a chance to hear Beethoven's Triple Concerto, where the Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung Won Chung will be joined by the pianist Franck Braly and the brothers Capuçon, Renaud playing the violin, and Gautier the cello. But first, it's over to Matthew Sweet for the first of this year's Proms Plus literary events.
Hello, and welcome to the first of our events in which we explore the ideas behind the music soaring out of the Albert Hall, which is just across the road. We're here at the Royal College of Music, and tonight, because of the surrounding presence of Messiaen and Dusapin, this programme will, I hope, be as Gallic as Jean-Paul Sartre eating a foie gras baguette. We're going to examine a few exquisite cuts of French literature, and they'll be interpreted for us by the actor Diana Quick, who's demonstrated her francophilia by playing the mistresses of both Napoleon and Henry II of France, and of to an anyone, the Croix de Guerre. And they have been chosen for us by my guests here tonight, the novelist and playwright Kate Moss, whose book Labyrinth and its sequels have raised the ghosts of France, and by the ceramicist Edmond Duval, whose memoir The Hare with Amber Eyes demonstrated his descent from a figure immortalised in one of the landmarks of French literature. Let's demonstrate our fraternité with them. Now, before we hear your choices, I want to see if we can have a go at naming some of the defining qualities of French literature. Historically, France has been very interested in defending the borders of its cultural identity. What preoccupations separated Kate Moss from the literature of its neighbours?
It's very louche. That's where I think we start with French literature, that it has this sense of a sort of texture of, on the one hand, telling you everything about the period of time you're reading about, whether it's sort of Flaubert, whether it's Mallarmé, whether it's Maupassant, but it's at the same time also this sense of a timelessness that is about the smells and the sights and the sounds and the slightly seedier side of life, whether it's in Paris or in Normandy or the provinces, anywhere else. So it's that louche quality that makes it work.
Edmund?
Well, I mean, that's the most brilliant description. I don't know how I can actually cap that at all. I mean, for me, actually, I'm not sure if I'm interested in French literature at all. I think I'm interested in Parisian literature. So I like the way in which the people I admire who write in French take on the city. And that's what I think differentiates the people I love from English literature, where I think there's always an anxiety about cities.
I want to discover something about your history with this national literature. Kate, you're from Sussex, aren't you? What did the literature of France mean to you growing up?
It meant nothing to me growing up. I think the reason that I have this sort of rather unpleasant zeal about Maupassant and other writers of the fin de siècle is that I was absolutely rubbish at French at school and didn't study it at all. But then years later, we bought a little house in Carcassonne in the southwest of France, and I fell in love with France. And so started to learn French and then started to read French. And so came to authors like Maupassant and Zola as a grown-up. And I think that did make an enormous amount of difference because I was sort of fully fledged by the time I was dealing with some of these slightly dodgier issues, shall we say.
How did you discover this literature, Edmund, while you were a small boy in Tunbridge Wells, or were you over the age of consent by the time you encountered these authors?
No, I mean, I did the great struggle, you know, schoolboy struggle with French, and indeed at university, reading English, I had to study French and failed. But actually, it was this journey over the last sort of 5, 6, 7 years into this strange family, unknown family history that took me into the literature in a completely different way. And rather like Kate is saying, discovering this country as a grown-up was utterly different. And that's what took me into Proust and the literature of the fin de siècle.
OK, well, let's hear some Proust, I think. Diana is going to read from the first volume of Proust's A la recherche de Tom Perdu.
Many years had elapsed, during which nothing of Combray, except what lay in the theatre and the drama of my going to bed there, has any existence for me, when one day in winter, on my return home, my mother, seeing that I was cold, offered me some tea, a thing I did not ordinarily take. I declined at first, and then for no particular reason changed my mind. She sent for one of those squat, plump little cakes called Petite Madeleine, which look as though they had been moulded in the fluted valve of a scallop shell. And soon, mechanically dispirited after a dreary day with the prospect of a depressing morrow, I raised to my lips a spoonful of the tea in which I had soaked a morsel of the cake. No sooner had the warm liquid mixed with crumbs touched my palate than a shiver ran through me, and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary thing that was happening to me. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses, something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origin. And at once the vicissitudes of life had become indifferent to me, its disasters innocuous, its brevity illusory. This new sensation having had the effect which love has of filling me with a precious essence. Or rather, this essence was not in me, it was me.
Thank you very much, Diana. Edmund, we've heard there what the Madeleine, this little cake, does to the speaker. What does it do for you?
Well, I mean, that's it, isn't it, really? It's how on earth do you capture this contingent, ephemeral moment where suddenly the whole of your body is alive to something you can't place? And it's the meaning, the bodily meaning of memory, which is so extraordinary. And it's a real thing for me. Not only because as a maker of objects, I'm always interested in actually what happens when you make something and let it go. So there's that sense of lost time actually in the objects I make, but also in this whole great quest for actually understanding time itself. And that's Proust.
This, I suppose, is one of his principal bequests to the culture, this idea that a thing, an object that you can experience with your senses can somehow trigger this great rush of memory and emotion.
Yeah, and there's no parallel to Proust anywhere else. You know, he really is completely sui generis.
Kate Moss, what do you make of this moment? Because one problematic thing that it might raise is the place of the exquisite in French literature. Maybe the idea that all of this can spring from an experience involving this little pastry object is not entirely a world away from, I know she didn't say it, but Marie Antoinette's reported remark, "Let them eat cake."
Yes, or brioche, indeed, as I believe it was. Well, I've already apologised to Edmund. Proust leaves me completely cold. And so, for me, that description, I would rather read Beckett writing about you know, Molloy, I think it is, eating his biscuits one by one. For me, that sort of sense, exactly as you say, of what memory is and how you capture it, I prefer it to be in active passages, if you like. So I would always rather somebody being run through with a sword, frankly, than eating a cake.
But have you never felt an analogous moment to that? Have you never had a sense, a memory, or an emotion triggered
like
by
a cake? You know, if offered a cake, I don't mind a cake. But no, for me, I think I can understand how beautifully done it is. For me, I suppose I like there to be a bigger gap between the writer and the text and me as the reader. So I like to be able to tiptoe towards the experience and have the writer take me so far and that we meet in the middle. So for me with Proust, it is too precise. It is too absolutely exquisite a capturing of a moment.
I think you need to jump to Marcel's defence here, Edmund. Why is this more than just something exquisite, something ecstatically beautiful?
Because. Firstly, because actually he deals not just with sort of adolescent moments of kind of great apprehension, and also not just because he deals with sort of with snobbery and social life in the Belle Époque and all those balls, all those parties, all those impressionist paintings, but actually he deals with loss. It's absolutely in its heart. It's an extraordinary book about trying to find what you've lost and trying to recapture really very painful emotions. There's a lot of profound skeletal substance there, which I really love. Actually, I read it again. Go on, read it again.
I'll try.
Okay, well, in the meantime, before you do that, let's hear an extract from one of the pieces that you've chosen, Kate Moss. And before Diana reads, you tell us what we need to know about Guy de Maupassant's Boule de Suif.
Well, I've chosen, in a way, possibly Guy de Maupassant's most famous short story. He wrote more than 300 short stories, 6 novels, and he's often seen as the father of the short story. And what he manages to do in sort of his nouvelles, as they were known, these sort of long short stories, is to capture an entire history through the experience of sometimes only 2 people, in the case of Boule de Suif, a well-meaning, gentle prostitute who finds herself with a mixture of bourgeois and revolutionary people under occupation during the Franco-Prussian War. And everything you need to know about the period of 1870, 1871 in France, the tensions that there were in different parts of society, the hypocrisy and the warm-heartedness is there in this one story. It's a masterpiece.
Diana Quick, let's hear it.
The coach lumbered slowly and laboriously forward. The wheels sank into the snow. The whole vehicle creaked and groaned. The horses slipped and panted and steamed, and the driver's huge whip cracked ceaselessly. It darted in every direction, knotting then uncoiling itself like a thin snake to give a sudden sting to a firm rump, which then tensed into greater effort. Imperceptibly, it grew lighter. The feathery snowflakes likened by one of the passengers, a Rouen man born and bred, to a fall of cotton wool, had stopped. A murky light filtered through vast, lowering clouds, whose leaden tints set off the dazzling whiteness of the countryside. Against it stood out here a row of tall trees covered with frost, there a cottage and a cowl of snow. Inside the coach, by the melancholy light of dawn, the travellers began to cast inquisitive glances at each other.
Thank you, Diana. Okay, Kate, why did you want to draw our attention towards this?
Well, I think, for me, I would say that Maupassant, although he is very much of his period, born in 1850, died in 1893 from syphilis, was incredibly productive in a very small period of time and was incredibly representative of a certain sort of lost generation of French chap. But at the same time, his stories are quite extraordinarily modern. So although he's writing about Rouen, and he's writing often about Paris, and he's writing about prostitutes and wives who are discontented and men who are dishonest, at the same time, he is talking about, in that story, Boule de Suif, what it meant to live under occupation. In other stories, he's talking what it means to be fearing you're going mad. So there's a wonderful story called In Lash, A Coward, where the man has been challenged to a duel and he has this great sense of who he is. And he's so worried about not living up to the idea of being a brave man that he kills himself before dawn because he can't cope with it. So the incredible sophistication of the psychology, the strange blurred line, I suppose, between madness and sanity, the sense of a society under pressure. And everything that he writes about the occupation of the Franco-Prussian War could have been written from 1939 to 1944, because actually he was prescient of what France was going to be. So for me, he is both perfectly of his time and also an extraordinary seer.
He's occasionally attacked for misogyny, isn't he? He's the founder of the Orange Prize.
Are you
anxious about pinning your colours to his mast?
We are in the hands of the translators. So when I first read Maupassant, I would have said, you know, his view of women is pretty dodgy. You could also say his view of men is pretty dodgy. He's very misanthropic. But when you read a more modern translation, or indeed, of course, you read Maupassant in French, you discover that actually he has both an incredible contempt for cant and hypocrisy, but also incredible warmth for the real men and women who are making the stories. So I would say that if you read a more modern translation, the Sean Miles translation, for example, of A Parisian Affair and other stories, you would read a translation that is more akin to Maupassant, whereas some of the older ones possibly were slightly, they brought their own agenda to the table in the translation, and that is, I think, where a lot of his reputation for misogyny comes from.
This is a fiction, Maupassant's fiction, deals with a totally different stratum of French society compared with the Proust that we were talking about. I guess the aristocrats of Proust might not have allowed some of these characters into their houses, not through the front door, anyway.
No, you know, you might look quite hard in Proust for some of the characters who turn up in Maupassant. I'm very intrigued, though, by the shape of his stories, because you're talking about modernity, I think, when you're talking about the need for that bit of space between the writing and the reader, which right at the beginning, Kate, and I think that's absolutely there in Maupassant, and I absolutely love that too.
And he has a very modern, again, I suppose you could call framing device, which owes as much to Edgar Allan Poe and indeed Baudelaire, and certainly M.R. James and Algernon Blackwood, those Edwardian great ghost story writers of English tradition who were going to come a couple of years after Maupassant had died.
OK, well, as Baudelaire has entered the room, perhaps it's now time to hear Dinah Quick read from his Twilight at Dawn.
Reveille was sounding in the barrack squares, and the morning wind was blowing on the lanterns. It was the hour when the swarm of malicious dreams makes brown boys twist and turn on their pillows, when, like a bloody eye throbbing and shifting, the lamp makes a red blur on the daylight, when the soul, beneath the weight of the reluctant, heavy body, imitates the struggling between the lamp and the daylight, like a weeping face dried by the breezes, the air is full of the shiver of fleeting things, and man is tired of writing, and woman of loving. The houses here and there were beginning to smoke. Women of pleasure, their eyelids bruised, their mouths open, were sleeping their stupid sleep. Female paupers, dragging their thin, cold breasts, were blowing on their embers and blowing on their fingers. It was the hour when, amid cold and miserliness, the pains of women in childbed grow worse. Like a sob cut off by foaming blood, the cry of the cock in the distance tore the misty air. A sea fog washed against the buildings, and the dying in the depths of the poorhouses were giving their death rattle in irregular gulps. The debauchees were heading home, broken by their labours. Dawn, shivering in a pink and green dress, was advancing slowly over the deserted Seine, and Sombre Paris, rubbing its eyes, was picking up its tools. A hard-working old man.
Thank you very much, Diana. OK, well, Edmund, this is the city. This is the grubby and the urban here, isn't it?
This is the city as you would never have read it before. I mean, this is the first person, I think, to really take on the texture of the city. I mean, and absolutely bring it alive. This is modern life. And there's a sort of compassion there, which is quite extraordinary. And I don't think you find that before.
This person, this figure of the observer, Kate Moss, is given a name as well. This is the flâneur, isn't it? A tremendously important figure in French literature.
Yes, and I think what Edmond says is absolutely right, that Baudelaire is the most pivotal of the writers, because without him, almost nothing that came after, the Madame group, all of those people, it would have been very hard to contemplate. And it's also the moment at which there starts to be this beautiful marriage, not just between writers and artists, but between writers and composers. And it is a period where, because anything went, in a funny sort of way, because of the great grief and depression of the Franco-Prussian War, the defeat, you know, the Prussians marching up the Champs-Élysées, the death of hope in the Commune, you suddenly had many young men, particularly, who felt liberated from their roles as soldiers, statesmen, and all the rest of it, and decided to devote themselves to art and being artists. And it does start with Baudelaire in the middle of the century, and him saying, this matters as much as anything else.
But the flâneur is quite a problematic sort of protagonist, isn't he? I mean, he's an observer. He doesn't get involved in the action quite, does he?
But that's what the modern city demands, you see. That's why Baudelaire gets it right about walking through the city, which is, how involved can you be? You walk down the great arcades, which are full of people, of the new goods and the things you can buy. You walk through these crowds, and what can you do except observe? So, in fact, and then describe, either as a poet or as a writer, or even bring it back to yourself and create some kind of artistic life at home. You know, be a dandy, be actually create some kind of aesthetic existence out of the way you live. So actually, flâneurs do matter enormously, and they, of course, lead ultimately to Proust as well.
OK, well, let's try and draw a few conclusions about what we've heard. Obviously, we've not attempted a great survey of French fiction, but I noticed that none of your choices have been from maybe that other tradition of French fiction, the rather more kind of violent and sensational sort, the Victor Hugo type of story. And I wonder what you think your choices that you've made might say about your own literary sensibilities, Edmond de Waal.
Oh, goodness me, that's a tough one. So where am I put on in the spectrum? I'm slightly flâneurial.
How exquisite are you?
I'm exquisite. I live with a few impressionists on my walls. Yeah, I think I put my hand up to all of that. I think that's exactly... You've got me nailed down completely. Miss out the Victor Hugo and put me on some beautiful apartment somewhere in Paris, preferably the turn of the century, and I'm extremely happy. And that's just fine.
Kate Moss.
I would say that with Maupassant, actually, there is the violence there. Whether it's sort of like Les Tombales, which is the woman who's in the graveyard looking for rich men for pickings, or La Ola, which many of you all know, which is the most appalling sort of psychological weirdness. And Baudelaire, of course, learned English specifically to translate Edgar Allan Poe. That was why he learned English, it's said. So I think that Gothic is always there under the surface in all of that literature, actually.
All right, well, here the guillotine has to fall down on this conversation. So everybody please put down your knitting and let's thank my guests here at the Royal College of Music, Kate Moss, Edmond de Waal and Dinah Quick. Thank you all.
Well, Matthew Sweet was talking to Kate Moss and Edmond de Waal. The reader was Diana Quick, and the next Proms Plus Literary event will be on Wednesday evening, when Peggy Reynolds will be exploring the cello in literature with Rana Mitter. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. I'm Rob Cowan. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom, which is devoted to just one work, Beethoven's Concerto in C, Opus 56, for violin, cello and piano, popularly known as the Triple Concerto. Beethoven first thought of composing a concerto for these particular forces in early 1802, possibly with his young piano student, the Archduke Rudolf, in mind. But whatever the genesis of this Triple Concerto, what's for sure is that it inhabits a bright, confident world, and while rarely plumbing the depths in the way that, say, the Fourth Piano Concerto does, it nonetheless has real scale. Tonight's trio of soloists are the Capucin brothers, violinist Renaud and cellist Gautier, and the pianist Franck Braly, all of them making their Proms debut, playing here for the very first time. I met up with them earlier on and asked them what challenges the work presents.
The difficulty of this piece, like the Brahms double concerto, but probably even more with a Beethoven triple, you need to find the right balance between the three instruments as a trio and as one voice.
And to find a character too, because this kind of lightness, this concerto, especially the first movement, can be a bit heavy or sticky, and we have to find this kind of lightness and
elegance
of C major, and also the spirit of the polka. So it's kind of tricky concerto to find the right balance, the right spirit, and it's unusual Beethoven.
And I would add it's a non-ego concerto. If you have three egos playing together, it just doesn't work. And it's, I guess, why it is so often played, and okay played, but not together played. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's trying to take the cover, and really often when you hear it with Swiss soloists, like big names, it's quite rare that it really works, because you can't just play as a concerto. You have to play, like, chamber music inside a concerto. And this is why it is such an interesting and special piece, I guess.
Well, Tom Service on his Guardian blog speaks about a very famous recording where big names are involved, Richter, Rostropovich and Oistrakh, with Karajan conducting. But the great piano trios have made the best recordings, the Beaux-Arts trio, the Oistrakh trio and the Stern-Roses Stoman. And, of course, tonight's lineup are going to be marvellous. They play chamber music together. The Capucins have recorded all the Beethoven violin sonatas to wonderful effect. And if the rehearsal this morning is anything to go by, then we certainly are in for a treat. In fact, when I say rehearsal, it was really a playthrough of the performance. There was very little to correct. The balance was so perfect with the orchestra that really there was nothing to... There was nothing to put right. Beautiful music making. Chamber music on a large scale, I'd say. Which is precisely what this music needs. Well, here they are now. A formidable and highly talented trio, if ever there was one, with the Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung-Woon Chung to perform Beethoven's Triple Concerto.
Thank you.
Well, as if that Polonaise ending isn't exciting enough, off Beethoven flies with that high-speed coda, brilliantly played there by the brothers, the violinist Renaud Capuçon, the cellist Gaultier Capuçon, and the pianist Franck Royally, with the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung-Woon Chung. The two brothers there communing in music, much as they do in life. They're great friends, and they're both recently fathers as well, they told me when I spoke to them earlier on today. I love the honesty and the directness of their playing, and Franck Royally is a real soulmate. It's such an integrated trio, and here they come again. Myung-Woon Chung stands back to let them bask in this applause, so well deserved. And they applaud the orchestra, who now stand. Well, we'll be back tomorrow with Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung-Woon Chung, with Weber's Oberon Overture, Brahms' Double Concerto, and Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. That's at 7 p.m. But now, time to hand you back to Ian Skelly and the rest of the evening on Radio 3.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. Rob Cowan, live at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight at the BBC Proms. Don't forget that there are a couple of ways to hear that prom again if you'd like to. It'll be here on the wireless on Wednesday afternoon this week during one of our afternoon proms repeat programmes. That's at 2 o'clock this Wednesday. Or if you prefer, you can listen again to it on the Radio 3 website any time of the day or night for the next 7 days. Tomorrow afternoon, by the way, you can hear the prom that appeared on Sunday night. And it was quite a night. The soprano Susan Gritton, the mezzo Christine Rice, the tenor Peter Orty, and the bass Alistair Miles joined, wait for it, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Youth Chorus, the Eltham College Boys Choir, the Southend Boys and Girls Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, the Huddersfield Choral Society, the London Symphony Chorus, and also the Welsh Choir Cor Cerdeth. Hardly room for the audience, I imagine. On the platform, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales was conducted by Martin Brabins, and they were all there to perform Havergal Brian's first symphony, the so-called Gothic Symphony. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Well, as Rob mentioned, Brahms is on the bill tomorrow night, his concerto for violin and cello, and I thought we could now hear some Brahms next this evening before the Liebrecht interview tonight. This is an early piece by Brahms, composed in difficult years for him as he struggled to overcome what he felt were the limitations of his compositional style, and as he battled to improve them, he poured out many a small instrumental piece, many of them juggling with the lessons that he'd learnt from the earlier masters like Bach and Handel. So you'll hear a Baroque-like contrabuntal theme to begin, followed by 11 variations in all here. They begin quietly, but soon lift off into a more energetic pace before returning rather majestically to the original theme at the end. This theme and variations is played by Garrick Olson. That was Garrick Olson playing a set of variations on an original theme by Brahms, the first of a set of two, Opus 21, as he sought to learn from the great masters of the past. And there's plenty more Brahms on the menu at the BBC Proms tomorrow night here on Radio 3. You can hear the double concerto by Brahms, a meltingly beautiful piece played by tonight's soloists, in fact, Gautier and Renaud Capuçon. And after the interval, a piece of music that swept away a great deal of what Brahms believed in, the crack of life as the spring dawns on a Russian landscape. Stravinsky's primal Rite of Spring. You can hear that prom given by tonight's orchestra, the Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France, live here on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 7 o'clock. An earlier start time because we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall for 10 tomorrow night for the first of the season's late proms. The Belcher Quartet will be joined by the cellist Valentin Erben to play Schubert's string quintet composed in the last months of his life. Music that shifts its mood from one moment to the next, and no doubt its rather ethereal middle movement will work particularly well with a late night audience. No doubt some of the promenaders lying on the floor staring into the dome above them as they listen to the music. Well, we'll be there. There, and you too can lie on the floor listening if you like by joining us for that late night prom at 10 o'clock tomorrow night here on BBC Radio 3. Well, next tonight we're going to meet Semyon Bychkov in an extended interview with Norman de Brecht. But before we leave the proms, a look ahead to a big event coming soon.
On BBC Radio 3 from the 2011 proms, a musical celebration of a great television event. Earlier this year, Human Planet brought to our screens some of the diverse cultures of the world with a musical soundtrack by Nitin Sawhney.
It was inspired by these incredible images, and I think if you write music that's inspired by incredible visuals, inevitably the music works in itself.
You can hear excerpts from Nitin Sawhney's score and also some of the performers heard in Radio 3's accompanying Music Planet series. A memorable Saturday night at the BBC Proms on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 3, and yes, it's time now for the first in a new series of the Le Brecht interview, where the writer and broadcaster Norman Le Brecht talks to leading figures in the musical world. So for the next three quarters of an hour, it's over to Norman Le Brecht.
Semyon Bychkov has become one of the world's most sought-after conductors by the scenic route. Rather than competing for trophy positions in major capitals, he rose from orchestras in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to Buffalo, before negotiating some crazy paving at the Orchestre Paris, then to Semperoper Dresden, and finally to the Radio Orchestra in Cologne, all the while acquiring a quiet fame for the refinement and power of his performances. He is the least well-known of leading maestros. Nearing 60, Bychkov has given up the last of his salaried jobs to pick and choose his diary dates. He's a regular at the BBC Proms, taking two of this summer's prime concerts, Verdi's Requiem and Mahler's Sixth Symphony. Born in Russia, finishing his education in the United States, he's married to the duo pianist Maria Labeck and had a brother, Yakov Kreitzberg, a much-loved conductor who died earlier this year. We meet in Paris, in the studios of Radio France. Semyon Bychkov, you can't get away from music. At work, at home, in summer, you've described yourself as obsessive. Is there a part of yourself that you hold separate from music?
No, not that I'm aware of. Why should I? It is my life.
It's everything?
It's everything, of course.
You wake up in the morning and it's music and you go to sleep at night? And
yes, and I think while I'm sleeping, I still have music in me. But, you know, it is not something that is separate from me. Mm-hmm. It is me. And I think it is true to every musician. I don't know a single musician who is not becoming music when making music or when thinking about music. It is just part of the air we breathe.
Always from your earliest memory?
Yes.
What was that memory?
That memory, I'm not sure that I know exactly the day of the week when suddenly it occurred to me that there is such thing that is called music. But when I was 5 years old, my mother took me to a house of scientists, which was a sort of club, if you wish, of scientists in Leningrad, which is today again St. Petersburg. My father, being a scientist, was a member of it. And so she wanted to know whether I had a musical talents as much as one can judge someone at 5 years of age. She herself played piano in her youth before the war started, after which it was all interrupted. And so, but she loved music very much. So she took me to this house of scientists, and I was diagnosed as having what is called absolute pitch, which is a capacity to identify on notes and a basic sense of rhythm. So those kind of things that one can say that a child would possess. And then I started my piano lessons, and ever since it was only music.
Did your mother play at home?
No, by that time she did not play piano anymore.
Did you have a piano? You had the whole family in one room.
Yes, she rented a piano at the time when I was accepted in that piano class at the House of Scientists. So I had an instrument. It was not ours, but I had a small piano to practice on at home. And she was sitting next to me and was sort of following my practicing. And so, yes, in that sense, she was quite present at that moment.
Did you think at the time this was quite a deprived beginning? You were living in one room, you shared a bathroom with four other families. It was just how people lived in Leningrad in the 1950s.
Not all people lived like this, but this is how we lived, and I didn't know any better, and so it was normal.
Your father was a scientist in the army. Why didn't he get the privileges that went with that job?
Well, actually, not everybody was getting privileges fast enough. And one of the privileges that he had was that in the early 60s, he was actually sent by the army to Kazakhstan, where lots of experiments and testing went on. And he was, in fact, a military man only because he belonged to the army, but he was, in fact, a scientist. And so he was sent to Kazakhstan. So from that moment on, we remained in Leningrad. And so he lived very far away, and we would see each other several times during the year, usually when he would have a vacation. And so it was normal to have a small room with a whole family living there and sharing it with other neighbors. Each one would have a room of their own and a common kitchen. That's what was called communal apartments. And it's pretty amazing because, you know, man gets used to everything. And so you get used to the idea that, okay, you cannot have a silence. Someone will be discussing whatever there is to discuss. Someone else will be practicing piano. You're trying to do your math homework and whatever. So you, in a way, get used to creating your own world of concentration where you are so fixated on the subject at hand that you are not disturbed by things that are going on around you. So I never felt myself deprived. Not at all.
And is that a useful skill in rehearsal, that concentration?
Concentration, focus? I think, is something that is indispensable in anything we do, whether it is rehearsal, whatever activity one has. Whatever you do, you have to concentrate on it. And therefore, you will have the greatest advantage in the, let's say you want to achieve something, you will have the greatest result possible only if there is absolute concentration at that particular moment. Once you've done it, you go on to something else, but then you will have to have concentration for that thing. So it is. I think it's just a wonderful training of being able to concentrate in circumstances that may not necessarily be considered as wonderfully luxurious.
You went to the Glinka Academy at 7, yes. And then to the Rimsky-Korsakov Conservatory.
Yes.
To study with
Ilya Musin.
Did you choose him? Did he choose you? There was Rabinovich as well, who was the other teacher. Did you know which one to go to?
Well, they were two great, great, great gurus, Rabinovich and Musin. They were actually wonderful friends. They had tremendous affection for each other, enormous respect. And so those two were rather gigantic personalities on the conducting paysage of not only Leningrad, but basically in the country, because it was that school in Leningrad that was viewed as the kind of mecca to go and study conducting, if this is what one wants to do. Now, your question whether I chose Musin or he chose me, first I chose him and after that he chose me, otherwise I wouldn't have been there.
Did you also sit in on Rabinovich? On his classes?
Yes, you see, it was so normal for us, so natural. We were sitting in everybody else's class. There were plenty of chairs. People were sitting and observing. And those were conducting students of the professor himself. Also pianists, composers, theory majors, even singers who would come to observe. Because it isn't only about conducting, finally. It is about view on music. It is about what music represents and whether you're a conductor or a violinist. only the instrument of expression changes. The search for expression is essentially the same. And so, yes, it was there that sometimes you would hear very astonishing things. A lot of the time it was very enlightening because you would hear those men who devoted their life to music, to thinking about it, reflecting on it, coming often to the same conclusion from completely different directions. There was a lot of polarity of opinions, a lot of discussion between professors and also between the students. And the amount of arguments that went on have absolutely nothing to do with the kind of totalitarian system that we were living in. That was another subject.
So it was a kind of refuge from the system. Once you came into the conservatory, you could close the door behind you and the system stayed
out
of the classroom.
No, you could not, because in the next hour you would find yourself in a classroom where Marxist-Leninist aesthetics were taught. And, of course, no one that I knew was the slightest bit of interested in it. But nevertheless, it was part of what one had to attend and an exam that had to be taken and somehow passed. It was basically, it was something everyone was laughing at quietly, but everyone had to do. There was no refuge in music, so to speak, because the reality of life and the reality of the system in which people lived was what it was. But music was stronger than any ideology. So that was the atmosphere in which we grew up.
You stood out quite quickly from the class. You won the Rachmaninoff conducting competition in 1973, which was a big thing. And that should have given you a debut with the Leningrad Philharmonic. That was the prize. What
yes.
happened?
Yes.
Didn't happen.
No, it did not happen. It did not happen twice.
That's a very good double non-happening. What happened?
The very first time I was invited after I won the Rachmaninoff conducting competition, and that was in 1973, I was invited to make my debut with the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra, which was unheard of for someone who was only 20 years old. And so Musin told me very quietly, he said, you know, I would advise you just to ask them to postpone your debut, because at the moment you could come under severe pressure and criticism. Just in case would be better to avoid. And so my debut was postponed. And 1 year later they called me again. They said, we would like to do your debut, and it will take place on the 28th September 1974. By then I would be in my fifth and final year at the conservatory. And so it was. And then I started getting in trouble with the authorities because my views on the system in which we lived and the ideology that was strongly imposed on us, my views became known.
How did you get into trouble?
It's very simple. It's enough for you to say something that you shouldn't say and for someone to hear it and report it.
Do you know what it was?
Do
you know who it was?
I know very well who it was. I know very well who were the people who reported my views to the authorities.
That musicians?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
And the views that they reported?
That I was politically unreliable.
In what respect?
Well, that I did not consider the dogma which we were taught, I did not really believe it. That the dogma was we lived in the best possible world.
But nobody believed it.
Yes, but you shouldn't
say
it.
They would have had to expel everyone.
But you shouldn't say it.
Ah.
You see, that's the difference. Right. As long as you don't say it, you can think what you want, but you should not say it. And if you only say that that's what you believe and you don't say it, you only believe it, you still shouldn't believe it because you shouldn't think it. But as long as you don't say that you're thinking it, it's all right.
So what made you say it?
Well,
you knew the risk.
Well,
you were young, you were impetuous, but you knew the risk.
Well, you know, I don't believe that one should accept living a lie. It's just that simple. You know, I think there is no harm in saying what you think. I mean, it's not a question of being reckless. It's just a very simple reality of life. I lived it very closely, watching my father, who was a great scientist, who, when he got out of the army and became a retired officer in reserve and wanted to, and still could, because he was still very young, get a job in one of the scientific institutions, one after the other refused him because they already had their quota of Jewish scientists filled and maybe fulfilled. And so even though they needed him and they wanted him, they couldn't take him. So imagine you live and you see your father during a whole year, going every day, looking for work and coming back and saying that, well, yeah, didn't work out. And again, didn't work out. It affects you because you realize that basically when the propaganda tells you that you live in a very just society where everyone is equal, the reality isn't so, in any case, not for everybody. It makes you think. So as a teenager, it became absolutely obvious to me that the reality and what we were led to believe did not really connect. And so you just say sometimes what you think, you can say it privately, which is what I did, but it became known to the authorities that I was not politically reliable.
So the concert was canceled?
The concert was first postponed from 28th September 1974 until 4th November 1974.
In the hope that you might become reliable in 6 weeks?
No, it was, I think, a way of trying to soften the blow. Because even though it was a very totalitarian society, it was a very complex society. Not everyone, certainly majority of the people were not informants of the KGB. Majority of people were decent. Majority of people did recognize that it would be very unjust to punish someone only because of what he happens to believe in. You know, and so I think that they genuinely wanted to soften the blow. And first they said the concert needs to be postponed. And of course, I knew very well that the writing on the wall was absolutely clear. So I knew that it's going to be trouble. And there were plenty of signs that were clear to me that the doors were really closing very gradually, just about everywhere. And then 1 week before the second date, I was finally told that the concert cannot take place, should not take place. And from that point, it was absolutely clear that I really don't have much of a future there. So then I migrated.
You applied for exit visa?
Yes.
Any difficulty?
Well, the difficulty, of course, is that you immediately become a person that people are afraid to have a contact with, a lot of people. So you sort of, at first, find yourself a little bit in a vacuum, but then suddenly turn up to be the real friends who approve of your decision. And suddenly you become close with people that before you didn't really even know. So, yes, it is not an easy process, and especially because you take a great risk of asking an exit visa without having any guarantee that you would be allowed to leave. You cannot work anymore. There was absolutely no guarantee that I would be able to leave the country.
You were not allowed to graduate.
Actually, I was expelled from conservatory the moment I applied for exit visa, and that was 4 months before my graduation. So 30 days later, after I have presented my papers with an application, a telephone call rang in the house with an invitation to appear the day after at the KGB office that was dealing with these matters. It was a Thursday, and so I was supposed to appear there on Friday to come and hear the verdict. It was very well known that Friday at 4 p.m. was the time when those who would be called in would be refused an exit visa. And so I went there knowing perfectly well that I will be refused. And of course they gave you 24 hours to get used to the idea that you will be refused. And so there were about 9 families that day that were called in. And one after the other went inside the reception, came out, and it was clear that the result was not exactly a very cheerful one for them. So finally my name was called, I went in, and there were 2 officers sitting around a table with a big cassette recorder running and recording every word that I might possibly say. And of course I was not saying anything, I was waiting. And so the man had my dossier right under his nose, and he said, so your application has been considered, and it has been decided to, and then he started turning pages as if he didn't know what the verdict was. It was decided to allow you to emigrate. Now, here I was pretty shocked because I came for a completely different answer, and here it is. And so the first question, and the only one I had the presence of mind to ask, is that, what am I supposed to do now? And they burst out laughing because the question was so idiotic.
And so you got out.
And three weeks later, I was gone.
But your father couldn't leave. Your father, they wouldn't give
a visa. No, he was refused for 12 years. And it was only when Gorbachev came to power and perestroika had begun that finally he was called in and told that he could go if he so wished. And so he emigrated and came to America and eventually lived his last 8 years of his life in France.
You flew out to Vienna?
Yes.
With your first wife?
Yes.
And what happened? I mean, you didn't know anybody? You just got off the plane in Vienna and... With a young wife?
Yes, and just like that.
How much money did you have in your pocket?
$100. That was all that we were allowed to take. And even if we were allowed to take more, we were too poor to have to have more than that. So, but we were met by the representatives of the HIAS, which is a Jewish agency that supports refugees. They asked us where we wanted to go, and we said that we would like to go to America. They said, okay, come with us. And so we spent 10 days in Vienna.
Any music?
Not very directly. However, about second evening after our arrival, I was walking on the streets and somehow found myself in front of the Staatsoper. And I see a poster which says Lohengrin, premiere, new production, conducted by Zubin Mehta. And so I was watching people going in. Of course, I couldn't get in. I was just watching. And finally, I could see that the doors were closed, the lights went down, the performance had begun, and I walked away. That is 1975. Exactly 30 years later, there was a poster of a new Lohengrin production, and my name was on it. And during the final rehearsal, I told the Vienna Philharmonic, which of course is the orchestra of the Vienna State Opera, I said, 30 years ago, there was a young man who was standing just outside of the doors watching people go in to hear Lohengrin conducted by Zubin. And that man was me. So here we are, except I'm inside. And so it was one little memento of my music in Vienna. And then 10 days later, we were taken to Italy and spent 6 months in Rome, waiting for the American papers. Mm-hmm. And so those were extraordinary 6 months of living in the free world. It was a fantastic cushion before going to America and starting new life.
There were one or two other Russian friends. Vitaly Margulis.
Margulis, yes, had become a very, 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 yes, yes. This was an extraordinary person. He was a wonderful pianist. He was more than a pianist. Piano was just an instrument of expression. And from him, I have received one of the greatest lessons in my life. He was a professor of Leningrad Conservatory. He could have been my father by age. And in Rome, we became very close. And one day, he was invited to go to Germany, to Freiburg, to give masterclass and a recital, as a result of which he was offered professorship. He was the first one of us who actually had a concrete, specific future, not only a dream of one. And so he came back to Rome on the train. I was at the train station, as many of us were there, greeting him like a hero. And so after hugs and kisses and congratulations, he announced that that evening there will be a party in the flat that he was renting. And so, of course, we were all invited. And I was, for some reason, late. And so by the time I came, the party was well on, and everybody was very joyful. It was a terrific atmosphere. The only thing was that I was told that he was waiting for me because he was planning to offer me some money. So I was prepared for trouble. And so after I had my chance to drink some wine and to eat some pasta, he said, you know, let's go to the next room. I'd like to tell you how it went to Germany. So, of course, we went, and he started telling me how the masterclass went, how the recital went, how warmly he was greeted by the Germans. So he was telling me all this. And finally, he said, you know, I made a little bit of money. I think he made about $500. I think that was the fee that he received. He said, I would like to share it with you. He offered me $20, and I didn't want to take it. I felt extremely uncomfortable. He kept arguing and trying to convince me, and I kept refusing. And then I saw that he had tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, I was successful now, and I was very fortunate, and I would like to share it with you. And I really want you to accept it. One day there will be someone who will need your help. And by helping that person, you will return this debt to me. And that was one of the greatest lessons I have ever learned.
So from Rome, Margulis, you reach America.
Yes.
Manus College, free scholarship. And then you went on to the first American orchestras, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Buffalo, upstate New York, both pretty formidable orchestras, but not major league. You didn't stay around to wait for a major league orchestra. You didn't actually see yourself as staying in America, or did you? What happened there?
You know, I never had a game plan because I don't view life as a game. And what I'm interested in planning is programs, for example, planning projects. Those are not plans, they're dreams. So you want to realize them. But they are not attached to a specific career situation or specific standing in a profession. Career is only a reflection. It's like a mirror. It reflects what you do. And nothing else, and nothing more. To run after the mirror is idiotic. At that time, it was exactly the same as it is today. I was fortunate enough to have these opportunities of being invited to conduct Grand Rapids Symphony, which was a regional orchestra consisting of young musicians. They were in search of music director. So it was a luck, it was a privilege, and the only thing that I wanted out of this for myself is opportunity to conduct the repertoire that I want to program, to learn the administration that needs to be learned, and in spite of the objection of people who were representing me professionally at that time, who said that it's not a good idea because you will typecast yourself as a minor orchestra conductor. And I said, I need to know everything about the problems this kind of orchestra will have, because the same type of problems, I'm absolutely sure, exist in the greatest orchestras in the world. Only the budget will be different. The quality of music making will be higher. The tradition will be more pronounced. But the challenges will be the same.
Semyon, you must be the only person in history who's had a call in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to come and conduct the Berlin Philharmonic.
Well, it happened.
It sounds as though you were right.
It so happened. But
and then Herbert von Karajan almost wrecked your career by saying that you might be his successor.
First of all, he never said it like this.
Ah, okay.
No, he never said it like this. He was asked often in the final phase of his life who he could see as his successor. In that particular interview, in that particular moment, I was on his mind because we have met very recently. It was after my second performance with the second trip in Berlin when Jochum has cancelled. The first one was Riccardo Muti who cancelled.
So this, you were commuting from Grand Rapids to Berlin.
No, I would not call it a commute. But at that time, Karajan, in fact, was editing his video just as I arrived. And I sat next to him while he was editing his film, and there were few minutes of his activity followed by very tedious waiting for the technical work to be done, which, of course, he was not involved in. And during the time, we talked for several hours, and I had plenty of questions to ask him, and that's what he loved. And he wanted to know what I'm doing, where I am. So I told him, I said, I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is sort of like your Ulm. And he laughed and he said, you're absolutely right. A few years of that and you're ready for anything. That was that meeting. And then some months later came out the interview in which he was, as always, asked the question. And he mentioned me as one of his possible successors. It was simply a way of showing approval for what he saw in his meeting with me. He approved of the way in which I thought about music and how I wanted to go about it. That was it. And so when you say that he nearly wrecked my career, well, I'm still here. Am I not? I'm talking to you. Why? Maybe there must be a reason why you wanted to talk to me. So he never wrecked my career.
No. But he gave you some turbulence at the time because there was an overestimation.
A turbulence comes regardless. Mm. It's only a question what it will come from and where. But if I ever had a choice of choosing between his approval or the approval of those who hated him, I think the answer is very clear. And so, for me, it's simply a privilege.
The reason we're here, in Paris, is because the next job you took was Orchestre de Paris.
Yes.
For 10 years.
Yes.
And that was even more turbulent.
Of course.
You had a tough time with that orchestra.
Very.
What was it? Was it a difference of background, difference of mentality, difference of culture?
Everything. You know, how many people go through a bad marriage in life? I think lots of people you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a bad marriage.
For 10 years?
9 years.
9 years. Yes. And it was bad from the beginning?
Soon after, yes. Yes. Well, you just mentioned the things, you know, it is basic incompatibility.
Incompatibility.
And so with marriage, there is always a big decision to make. Are you going to stay together and try to make it work? or you don't. Well, for 9 years we tried to make it work, and it didn't. And then it came to an end. And that's all there is to it.
That didn't depress you?
Of course
that
it did.
That constant struggle?
Of course it did. Of course.